I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. One of my favorite left-wing economists and theorists has been Sam Bowles, and I was just delighted to find out recently from a newspaper article in the Santa Fe Reporter that Sam Bowles is now working at the Santa Fe Institute, which is also one of my favorite think tanks. It's an institute that was started 20 years ago to work on topics of, maybe 25 years ago now, to work on complexity theory. And it has attracted many different scholars to work for several years at a time there. And Sam Bowles is heading up the behavioral sciences program at Santa Fe Institute out there in New Mexico. So I'm going to read a little bit of this article called Born Poor about his work at the Santa Fe Institute, applying their complexity theory, his work on inequality to their complexity theory and vice versa. And some of the conclusions that he draws are going to be familiar to listeners of Change Surfer Radio. So he starts, I'm starting in the middle of the article by Corey Payne, P-E-I-N. They're talking here about the Gini coefficient, which is a measure of inequality. Zero describes the ultimate level playing field, a non-existent land in which everyone has all the same stuff, a completely unequal society in which one person has sole control of literally everything, would have a Gini coefficient of 100. New Mexico's Gini coefficient score is 25.7, and this reveals the state is more unequal than most. Utah is the most egalitarian state with 41.3 Gini coefficient, while the District of Columbia is at 53.7 and is the most economically polarized in the country, according to the most recent census report from 2006. The Gini coefficient for Sweden, the world's most egalitarian country, is 23. Whereas most of Europe, Canada, and Australia have Gini coefficients in the low 30s. The U.S. has, over the past several decades, developed inequalities usually found only in poor countries with autocratic governments. So what? Isn't inequality merely the price of being an American? That's almost certainly false, Bowles tells SFR, the Santa Fe reporter. Prior to about 20 years ago, most economists thought that inequality just greased the wheels of progress. Overwhelmingly now, people who study it empirically think that it's sand in the wheels. Bowles can take some credit for that shift, but he hasn't won the battle. Most economists don't study things empirically, that is, by looking at things in the real physical world. Instead, they stay safely within the land of theory. Theory land may be the only place that the equality efficiency trade-off really works. Just to prove it wrong, Bowles charts the concept on a whiteboard at the Santa Fe Institute. The vertical axis is economic output. The horizontal axis is equality. The curve shows the theoretical trade-off. So we're here, point A, high on the curve, and we want to go to point B because we're egalitarian. And the theory says that that's kind of too bad because we're going to suffer a loss of income. Bowles draws another dot inside the curve, point C, symbolically destroying the clean, simple world represented by the model. Basically, it assumes that the economy is already efficiently organized, Bowles explains. But most economies are at point C. They have both more inequality and less income than they could have because they're inefficient. The fan club for Bowles' reality-based approach to economics includes Ona Porter, executive director of Community Action New Mexico. She first encountered his work while reading the Stanford Social Innovation Review. "It's really my job to be paying attention to what cutting-edge theory and practice is," she says. Among other projects, Community Action lobbies the New Mexico Public Regulation Commission on behalf of low-income residents, opposing rate increases by the Public Services Company of New Mexico. Constantly, Porter says, it's our voice against the suits. Her on-the-ground experience supports a message that Bowles has pushed all these years in academia. Inequality, she says, really holds us back. Bowles offers a key reason why this is so. Inequality breeds conflict, and conflict breeds wasted resources, he says. In short, in a very unequal society, the people at the top have to spend a lot of time and energy keeping the lower classes obedient and productive. Inequality leads to an excess of what Bowles calls guard labor. In 2007 paper on the subject, he and co-author Arjun Jayadev, an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts, make an astonishing claim. Roughly one in four Americans is employed to keep fellow citizens in line and to protect private wealth from would-be Robin Hoods. The job descriptions of guard labor range from imposing work. Think of the corporate IT spies who keep desk jockeys from slacking off online, to enforcing laws, like the officers in the Santa Fe Police Department paddy wagon parked outside of Walmart. The greater the inequalities in a society, the more guard labor it requires, Bowles finds. This holds true of U.S. states with relatively unequal states like New Mexico, employing a greater share of guard labor than relatively egalitarian states like Wisconsin. The problem, Bowles argues, is that too much guard labor sustains illegitimate inequalities, creating a drag on the economy. All the people in guard labor jobs could be doing something more productive with their time, perhaps starting their own businesses or helping to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China. Guard labor supports what one might call the beatdown economy. Community Action's Porter sees it all the time. "We have based almost everything we have done on the idea that we always need a part of our workforce that is marginalized, that we can call this group into action at any time, pay them nothing, and they will do whatever needs to be done," she says. More discouraging, perhaps, is the statistical fact that a person born into this workforce has little chance of rising beyond it. Two more numbers, 30 and 32. The first is the likelihood expressed as a percentage that a child born to parents whose incomes fall within the top 10% of Americans will grow up to be at least as wealthy as their parents, 30%. The second is the likelihood that a person born into the bottom 10% of society will stay at the bottom, 32%. Just to drive the point home, here's a third number, 1.3. That's the percentage likelihood that a bottom 10%er will ever make it to the top 10%. So 1.3% of them would ever make it to the top 10% of income. For 99 out of 100 people, rags never lead to riches. These estimates come from research by one of Bowles' former students, American University economist Tom Hertz, published in Unequal Chances, a 2004 book he co-edited with Bowles. To arrive at these figures, Hertz mined the panel study of income dynamics, a survey of 4,800 American families that's been updated each year since it began in 1968, the year Martin Luther King inspired Bowles to study inequality. It may not come as a shock that rich kids who grow up learning to sail eventually buy yachts, while the offspring of burger flippers might hope to rise to be the night managers for whole crews of burger flippers. What's troubling about this research is that poverty tends to persist through generations, no matter how individuals try to improve their circumstances. So, much of what Americans tell their children is wrong. It doesn't really matter how long you go to school or even necessarily how hard you work. The single most important factor to success in America is one's choice of parents, as a contributor to Unequal Chances put it. What about natural intelligence? The problem with IQ, says Bowles, is that it's just not very important in determining who's rich and who's poor, and most people don't believe that. What about education? Well, says Bowles, being willing to sit in a boring classroom for 12 years and then sign up for 4 more years and then sign up for 3 or 4 more years, well, that's a pretty good measure of your willingness to do essentially what you're told, Bowles says. This bodes ill for the American dream of upward mobility. It also puts the lie to a can-do cliche underpinning much U.S. economic policy, namely that people in need should get a hand up rather than a handout. The economic rationale for putting a cap on unemployment benefits and severely restricting welfare, even for the poorest Americans, is that people won't look for work if the government is too generous. If Bowles is right, however, the answer is more handouts, not less. More importantly, handouts for whom? If Bowles has the history of wealth figured out all the way back to the Stone Age, shouldn't he have some practical advice? Well, indeed he does. Here's one number will suffice. $250,000. Okay, that's a figure that Bowles picked out of the air. It's how much each person might receive under a key economic reform that he supports, universal welfare. It could also be called direct government investment in everyone. After all, taxpayers already invest in strangers' children through the public schools before turning them loose with nothing. Suppose instead what we did is this, he says. Look, when somebody turns 18, he gets $250,000, and after that, you're on your own, Bowles says. Once you've got your $250,000, you've got to make a decision. Should I go to college, or do I want to start a business? Which you could do with $250,000. This is a variant of an old idea more recently popularized, at least in Europe, by the Belgian economist Philippe Van Parie. Under his basic income grant proposal, the government would distribute wealth so that everyone has enough to live. They just get a check, and they get it no matter what. Rockefeller, the poorest person in America, everybody gets it, Bowles says. There's nothing you can do to get more. There's nothing you can do to get less. Such a system eliminates the disincentives to work in the current social safety net. The problem with the welfare system is that as soon as you get a job, they start taking your money, Bowles says. This is basically saying, you've got this nest egg, and if you go out and get a job, you keep the whole thing, except for whatever taxes that you pay. Can you hear the Friedmanites groaning? It sounds very radical, Bowles says, but it's very consistent with economic ideas. It makes at least as much sense as giving hundreds of billions of dollars to Wall Street's largest banks, some of which helped cause the recession, so that the banks can lend it back to taxpayers at outrageous interest rates. Bowles' suggestions, radical yet oddly conservative, also mesh well with his general approach to economics. The Santa Fe Institute professor isn't as easy to pigeonhole or dismiss as other lefties who believe the assumptions of mainstream economics, for instance, that people behave rationally, are bogus. This is George Washington University economist named Farrell. Sam Bowles is somebody who straddles the boundary. He maintains the idea that there should be radical redistribution, that the current system is a terrible system in a variety of ways, but he's also somebody who believes the methodological tools of economics have some real value. I think that what he's doing is very smart, and it actually has some promise for a future coherent research agenda. Three more numbers, none of them lucky. 42, 38.8, and 46.4. The first is how many years have passed since Bowles was inspired by Martin Luther King to put his heart and his head together and study economic inequality. The second is the Gini coefficient for the United States back then, that's 38.8, a level comparable to other wealthy nations like Japan or Israel today. The third is the most recent U.S. Gini coefficient, 46.4. as calculated by the Census Bureau. It's at a level comparable to the Philippines, a former colony of islands where every other person lives on less than $2 a day, or Rwanda, an even poorer country in Central Africa that was home to genocide 16 years ago, a country whose name is often synonymous with hopelessness. And again, that's an article called Born Poor, about the work of Samuel Bowles, a left-wing economist who is now working at the complexity theory think tank Santa Fe Institute out in New Mexico. He's heading up their behavioral sciences program. I'm just delighted to hear about his work. Now, also in inequality-related news, a growing number of studies in neuroscience are showing that there are evolved capacities or predispositions towards certain kinds of moral judgments about cheating and freeloading and sharing and fairness in our monkey brains. And I've talked about this on Change Surfer before, but here's a nice little summary from brainblogger.com, a piece called The Brain Rejects Inequality, written by Jennifer Gibson. The human brain likes balance, not simply biological and physiological homeostasis that maintains the proper functioning of the brain, but emotional, social, and psychological balance. Notably, the human brain dislikes inequality when it comes to money and rejects it at all costs, according to new research in the journal Nature. Behavioral and anthropological evidence shows that humans dislike social inequality and unfair distribution of outcomes. But this evidence is not purely social anymore, since researchers at the California Institute of Technology and Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, have identified reward centers in the brain that are sensitive to inequality. The authors examined functional magnetic resonance images, fMRI images, of participants as they were presented with money transfer scenarios. The volunteers participating in the study were initially randomized into two conditions: one, to receive a large monetary endowment at the beginning of the study, $50, or to start with no money. Participants were assigned to pairs, one participant from each of the monetary conditions, and the participants were offered the chance to transfer sums of money between $0 and $50 between them. The interesting finding was that the brain's reward centers in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and ventral striatum responded differently to the money transfer offers depending on whether the participant started the experiment with money or without. Not surprisingly, the brains of the people who started the experiment with no money had strong reward-focused reactions to gaining money themselves, and basically no reaction to money going to someone else. However, the brains of people who started the experiment with money had a stronger reaction to other people gaining money than gaining money themselves. So they got some pleasure out of other people getting money. This research is among the first to show that a dislike of fairness and inequality is more than just a social convention. On a physiological level, people are not as selfish as once believed. Similar studies preceding the current research have demonstrated that the VMPFC, that ventromedial prefrontal cortex, is involved in making value-based decisions, including monetary gain, donations to charity, and reciprocity. In several experiments, the brain rejected inequality and unfair offers, whether the outcome was monetarily advantageous or disadvantageous for the participant. Some researchers still claim that this behavior is based on emotions rather than physiology. They postulate that humans reject inequality and attempt to restore fairness owing to anger or moral disgust over an unjust situation. Further, others contend that people who have money want to restore equity and balance to assuage their guilt and decrease their own discomfort over having more than other people. Well, that's moral sentiment as well. While the new study demonstrates that humans are not completely focused on their own self-interest, it's unclear how the physiological evidence translates to behaviors in the real world. Humans experience physiological and emotional rewards from helping others and donating to charities, but the brain seems to stop short of wanting to redistribute wealth across the board, or certainly across the world. The association between work, reward, equality, and the brain's mechanisms underlying them all remain unclear. And then she goes on to cite six articles that have looked at this reward center in the brain and its relationship to charity and fairness and so forth. So this is, again, just a short piece from brainblogger.com, a piece called "The Brain Rejects Inequality." Now, also on the equality-inequality theme, I'm going to self-indulgently read the piece that I recently wrote for io9.com. Io9 is one of my favorite blogs. It's a science fiction blog. It was founded by Anna Lee Newitz, who is a staunch techno-progressive of long standing and someone who I have followed the work of ever since she was doing Techsploitation was the name of the columns that she was writing back 7-8 years ago. But now she's founded and runs io9.com, and I highly recommend that you read it. She did a series of articles and gathered a series of resources about post-humanity, the concept of post-humanity, last week, and I wrote my usual screed about human racism, and I thought I'd just read it here. Beyond the Human Race and Human Racism, jhughes@io9.com, May 12th, 2010. The problem with the idea of post-humanity is that the thing that it is supposed to be beyond, humanness, is an imagined community to begin with. So why imagine post-humanity at all? There will certainly be identities that unite and divide us in the future, and some of them may revolve around the technologies that we use to modify our bodies. People who have had nose jobs or vaccinations, or who have pacemakers or prosthetic limbs, may feel some faint, abstract solidarity with one another. But few think of themselves as technologically modified transhumans who are transcending their humanness. So why do we imagine that our descendants will suddenly feel this desire to declare themselves a new species? It's as if we were 16th century peasants trying to imagine the 20th century when monarchists will have to confront the scary power of the postmonarchists. We are postmonarchists today, but our myriad modern identities and factions have nothing to do with monarchy. I have contributed to this illusory post-humanity problem. As a transhumanist, my comrades and I talk a lot about transhumans and posthumans as if there will be such a break. But I fear that accepting these terms carries a lot of unnecessary baggage that plays into the hands of the, quote, human racists, those who believe that there are clear boundaries that define humanness, which must not be transgressed. Some become human racists because they believe man was created in imago Dei, in the image of God, and that messing around with our bodies and brains violates a divine plan. But there are also plenty of secular people exercised about defending humans against post-humans. In 2002, for instance, the liberal bioethicists George Annis and Laurie Andrews published Protecting the Endangered Human toward an international treaty prohibiting cloning and inheritable alterations in the American Journal of Law and Medicine. They argued for an international treaty to make cloning and germline genetic therapy crimes against humanity, a call taken up by other would-be defenders of humanness. Annis went further to opine, "The post-human will come to see us, the garden variety human, as an inferior subspecies without human rights to be enslaved or slaughtered preemptively. It is this potential for genocide based on genetic difference that I have termed genetic genocide that makes species-altering genetic engineering a potential weapon of mass destruction." Okay, so what exactly is this human genome that needs such a defense? It can't include the 99% of our genetic code we share with other species. Hopefully, it isn't reducible to genes for hairlessness or upright posture or hidden estrus, since I doubt that we would deny citizenship to anyone born of humans who lacked these traits. If defending this human genome requires throwing would-be genetic enhancers before The Hague, we can hopefully figure out which genes in particular are key. Perhaps if we examine human genetic origins, we could pinpoint the key genes that caused us to suddenly mutate into humans. But the paleogenetic record just mucks up the idea of humanness. The publication last week of genetic comparisons of humans and Neanderthals revealed that our two species were interbreeding as recently as 60,000 years ago. Only Africans appear to have escaped the taint of Neanderthal miscegenation. Today, our closest cousins are the great apes, and the human racists insist that there is a clear shining line between us and them. But that line also erodes daily, as apes are shown to use language, transmit culture, and understand abstract ideas like death and morality. The Great Ape Project campaigns to have human rights extended to apes to protect them from slavery and torture on the grounds that they possess all the mental characteristics necessary to possess rights. In Imagined Communities, A History of the Manufacturing of Nationalism, Benedict Anderson notes, "Regardless of the actual inequality and exploitation that may prevail in each, the nation is always conceived as a deep, horizontal comradeship. Ultimately, it is this fraternity that makes it possible, over the past two centuries, for so many millions of people not so much to kill as willingly to die for such limited imaginings." Isn't it clear that human racism, like nationalism and racism, is just another effort to suppress the divisions between haves and have-nots in favor of a fictional solidarity of humans against illegal immigrants who haven't even arrived yet, and when they do, will be us and our children? When Francis Fukuyama argued in Our Post-Human Future that genetic drift would destroy the biological equality that human rights were based on, he was invoking a fictional history in which we granted one another rights simply because we recognized some biological commonality that allowed every human being to, quote, potentially communicate with and enter into a moral relationship with every other human being on the planet, end quote. But there are no post-humans proposed by human enhancers, and few imagined in science fiction, who would be unable to communicate or enter into moral relationships. If the imaginary moral community of humanity is flexible enough to expand beyond white male property owners to all human beings, surely it can expand a little further to include gorillas and cyborgs and mutants. In the coming century, we will begin to genetically modify ourselves to escape from disease, disability, and death. We will begin ramping up our brains and bodies with designer drugs and nanobots. The fight to ensure universal access to the benefits of these technologies began a long time ago with the fight for universal health care and will continue when we are trying to get cheap longevity drugs and brain jacks out to rural villages. I suspect that the unmodified humans of the future won't divide the world into humans and post-humans, but into those who are on the side of wider access to enabling technologies, and those who side with corporations and governments to deny them that access. So let's be careful about the idea of a post-humanity, even if we're celebrating its advent. And that was the piece that I published at io9.com and then at iet.org called Beyond the Human Race and Human Racism, May 12th. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.